This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, They shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Committing terrorism and breaking agreements are quite normal for the Israeli regime. And as the regime continues its terrorist campaigns and kill more Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, the Zionist prime minister is going to Washington. Instead of being arrested due to the warrant on his head from the International Criminal Court for committing war crimes, Benjamin Netanyahu will be welcomed at the White House and meet with the U.S. president. And instead of abiding by its agreement to start the second phase of peace talks in Doha, the Zionist regime seems to be taking orders from its masters in Washington. But what will those orders be?
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington at a time when Gaza ceasefire negotiations were supposed to take place in Doha. Seeking U.S. backing, this untimely trip questions Israel's commitment to a ceasefire deal. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman did not mince his words as he reacted sharply.
We are talking about, as I said, an Bengali character whose second nature is cunning and malicious. As everyone knows, he is a genocidal criminal who is wanted by the International Criminal Court for committing genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, who has traumatized the whole region and indeed the whole international community. Now he's in the United States soil, the location of the headquarters of the United Nations, the same venue that the International Convention for Prevention and Criminalization of Genocide was adopted.
Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, negotiations were set to resume on Monday, the 16th day of the ceasefire. As negotiations stall, in Gaza, the situation on the ground remains dire. Israeli warplanes have targeted civilian vehicles in central Gaza, further escalating the humanitarian crisis. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, Israeli military operations have intensified, with over 70 Palestinians killed since January. A UN expert has warned that Israel's actions indicate an intent for genocide. The recent offensive in Jenin, dubbed Operation Iron Wall, has resulted in deadly airstrikes and significant destruction. Doctors Without Borders has condemned the surge in violence as unacceptable. And in the midst of this turmoil, southern Lebanese villagers are facing ongoing occupation despite a ceasefire agreement.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London. And Saad Nim, professor of political science at Birzeit University out of Ramallah.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me. Let's start it off in London. And Said Mohsen, I mean, what does it mean that even after the ceasefire agreement, the Zionist entity is still targeting Gaza? And just yesterday, it killed another child as his family's car was targeted.
Well, it means the genocide hasn't stopped, Marzia. There's never really been an intention by Netanyahu or America or the Israelis to stop the genocide. All they've done is, let's get the context right, the Israeli forces were demoralized, depleted, destroyed, and many of them were becoming deranged, PTSD levels and all sorts, injuries. When you start looking at the real figures, it runs into tens of thousands of Israelis who were actually hammered in this kind of failed campaign. The country is $67 billion in debt because of this war. ILEP Corp bankrupt. They had a throttle placed upon them in terms of trade coming through to them to that by the Yemeni Ansarullah. And of course, Hamas still remained strong and the tunnels still stayed in place. So the hostages clearly were still not returned. So the bottom line is Netanyahu failed on every one of his objectives in this genocidal assault, except for demolishing a lot of buildings, killing a lot of children. Now, what did that mean? It meant that Netanyahu needed relief. He needed to strategize. He needed to reload. And Donald Trump has been providing him with more 2,000 kilogram bunker bombs, of course. And he needed to recover politically as well, internally. So I think they also had the Syria front that opened up. They had the bonanza of Turkey and Jilani handing over Syria to them, which they have to also secure. And they also wanted relief from the fact that they've been hammered by Hezbollah in the north. So add to this, of course, the desettlement of the illegal settlers in the north, in Kiryat Shemona, and down in the south with of course, Ashkelon. And you had 500,000 or so displaced Israelis. And of course, a dying economy and a struggle like that meant they needed to really just replenish themselves. And of course, don't forget Netanyahu had Donald Trump coming into power. So Donald Trump needed to look like he had some victories that he started off with. But actually, all of this ultimately, and in summary, is potentially just bluff and bluster and just buying time for what they really want to do. And the other evidence that the genocide didn't stop is that they imposed a huge attack on Jenin and with the West Bank, and a massive attack has gone on there. So the genocide's continuing over there as well. So I don't even see that the genocide in any way was ever stopped, and there was no ceasefire of real meaning.
All right, Saad, the second phase of Gaza peace talks were supposed to start in Doha today, but instead of sending a delegation there, Netanyahu is in Washington. And what exactly does this mean in your perspective, timing-wise, and what do you think is going to be accomplished?
Good evening to you, Mrs. Hashemi, and your guest from London, and to all your viewers. Well, I believe that the second term of this deal is the one, let me say, very, very important and very crucial. The first one, it was about, you know, some ideas related directly to exchange prisoners and to redeploy the Israeli army from some areas to allow people from the south to go back to the north. And this we can understand. Now, the second phase, it's taking more, if you like, important issues, which will more or less politically address what's next in Gaza and who's going to rule Gaza. Because it depends on also a total withdrawal of the Israeli army from all of, especially Philadelphia crossings, and from Netzarim as well, to the Israeli borders. Now, what's next, and who's going to rule Gaza? The Israeli are insisting, and Netanyahu especially, insisting that Hamas should have no role in whatsoever in Gaza, but the reality, Hamas is still intact and still in its power, and Israeli had to sit with them and to negotiate with them over all these deals. So it's still there, and this is a big problem, and one of the issues that's going to be discussed in the United States with Trump. Because of that, I think even the Israeli, they believe that, and especially in the media, that Netanyahu is going to be committed to the first part, which is the 42 days, which is still going on now, and try to install the second one, or to be more tough in the second stage, and to put some obstacles in front of this stage, in spite of the fact that the borders of this stage has been set with the in Doha. But still, the Netanyahu is going to store it somehow, and that's why he didn't send his delegation to Doha, though it's supposed to be today, the day for this, start the discussion on the second stage. And instead, he said, after I meet Trump, then I'll come back, because he wants to know that if Trump is going to support him in reopening the war again in Gaza or not, because some important ministers in his coalition threatening him of not only withdrawing from the government, but to collapse the government and going for an early elections if he didn't do so, to start the war again after the first stage. So he's in a dilemma in a way or another, and he wants the support of Trump in this issue. Now, what is more important? His government and his resignation and going for early elections and facing also the problems that he's facing in Israel, which is the corruption cases, or the humans in Gaza and restarting the war again in Gaza, in spite of the fact that, as your guest has just mentioned, that the Israeli army is totally exhausted, and they were complaining about being in Gaza without no targets. What kind of new targets do they have now? So nothing has changed, except just killing the people and continuing with this genocidal war.
Well, Saad Mohsen, your perspective, why does Netanyahu have to go to Washington to discuss the second phase of the ceasefire before sending anyone to Doha? I mean, is it reality that it is the U.S. who is actually deciding what the Zionists should agree to during these talks?
I think there are far more powerful forces behind both Trump and Netanyahu that decide what really goes on anywhere. But that's by the by. Let's play, for example, the game that actually it's Netanyahu and Trump who make these decisions. In that case, the reality is that we know Donald Trump and Netanyahu have bigger ambitions than just taming the Palestinian problem. You know, that, as far as they're concerned, the real root of that problem, they think, is Tehran and is Iran. So what he's got to go, Netanyahu partly is going to go, I think, to Donald Trump to see if he can get clearance to tackle the root of the problem, because he still wants the nuclear weapons of Iran, the military power of Iran, the ascendancy and dominance of Iran as an independent military and sovereign state to be undermined. He really does want that. So I think that's definitely going to be on the horizon. And partly to do that, if they were to start this wider war on the periphery of their so-called enemies, they would need to have the home front a little bit calmer. I don't think you can have, of course, an entire war waged in Palestine and in the borders, on the borders with Lebanon, and then take on Iran. Tactically, you would have thought they wanted calm here to subdue what's going on in Syria, make sure everything's firm there, before they actually turn to destabilizing Iraq and destabilizing the Islamic Republic of Iran and also Yemen. They haven't forgotten those realities, and I think they still have this delusional ambition to break the axis of resistance. I think we can't forget that. And Palestine and the Palestinian resistance is firmly part of that entire wider axis of resistance, and they have to play their strategic game very carefully. At the same time, of course, he's got the reality that you know, he needs to see whether he can actually annex Gaza. They still have that intention. The words of the ideas of Amalek, the ideas of exterminating Palestinians and expelling them, is being done in a different language now, Mirzia. Because when Trump came in, the first thing he said was, "We need to rehouse, redo a humanitarian exercise in saving all these poor Palestinians from being killed by sending them to Egypt, by sending them to Jordan, finding other places to export them to." Indeed, I heard Turkey today was willing to take some of the Palestinian prisoners that are being released. They're saying we'll take some of them. So already there are these indications, but there's been a rejection, it seems, from Egypt, and the Jordanians are very nervous about this idea of the Palestinian issue being thrown into their quarters, because there's another game there. If you push the Palestinians and displace them even more into Egypt and Jordan, there's a danger that Israel will say, "Oh, actually, we've still got problems of Palestinians coming over the border, so now we'd like to invade Egypt, and we'd like to invade Jordan as well, and annex those two as well." And they've got their eyes on the Suez Canal, perhaps. You cannot discount the ambitions of the likes of imperialist folk like Trump, who think they can annex Greenland and annex Panama and annex wherever they want. They are an imperialist, out-of-control, imperialist, psychopathic entity.
Right, right. Stay with me, Seth Mohsen. Let me get Saad back in on this discussion. I mean, Saad, the Israeli regime continues to violate its agreements, not only with Hamas and Gaza, but also with Lebanon, where it was supposed to leave after 60 days from the agreement, but still destroying parts of southern Lebanon. I mean, what does it mean that those who were the guarantors of these agreements are basically doing nothing to the regime to try to make it abide by its commitments?
Yes, this is something that Palestine had to take into consideration, because since when Israel do committed to any of the agreements that they had with whoever? Since Muhammad, peace upon him, till today, they are, you know, even after 1967, after the 1973, even 48, and we have all these records for Israel breaking any kind of deal, whether they like this deal or even if they didn't like it, like what happened today with the deal list for the exchange of prisoners and evacuating Gaza. They didn't like it, so definitely they are going to do something about it by, you know, breaking the deal. It so happened also in Lebanon, and in Lebanon not only they delayed the whole thing of the withdrawal 60 days, but also they now are demanding more times, and the Americans gave them. And the Americans are part of the guarantors of this agreement. The same with Hamas. We are talking about Doha, Egypt, Egypt, Qatar, and America. And they see every day, on a daily basis, the what the Israelis are doing, and apparently no way. And that will bring the big question, to what extent these guarantors really could you know, prevent Israel from breaking these deals and going ahead with their own ideas, in spite of the fact that they were forced to do this deal, because it's not, you know, they are not victorious to say that, you know, we can do whatever we want. And that's how they are acting today in Lebanon. They think and they promote the idea that they are winners in this war, while they, everyone knows that they are not. The same was yesterday when Netanyahu was about to get to his airplane to go to United States. He said after the victory on Gaza and you know, victory over Hamas, and that was like a joke among the Israeli journalists and Israeli media this morning. That what victory are talking about? What kind of victory? And we saw what happened during the exchange and how Hamas was not only militarily is there existing, but also administratively in Gaza. They are the one who's ruling. So what kind of victory have you achieved in there? So usually under pressure they have to sign these agreements, but they think that they have the right to break it whenever they want, because as they put it always, the security of Israel is more important than anything else. More important than the agreements, more important than the international law, more important than the humanitarian international law or anything else. It's the security of Israel and how they are justifying these kind of things when they are breaking these commitments. However, I think that the Palestinians were very much focusing on during the negotiations in the last month, at least, on this issue particularly, because we know that they are breaking the deal. 2014, after the deal to release Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was captured by the Palestinian resistance, for around 1,000 Palestinian prisoners, Israel later on, they arrested 49 of them, though they were among the agreement that they shouldn't be arrested, and they arrested 49 of them, you know, to continue their sentences. It means that they never, you know, and that's why the Palestinians wanted to be sure that those guarantors are able really to stop Israel from this breaking of any agreement going to be signed. Mm-hmm.
Well, Seth, most of the death toll in Gaza is more than 62,000 people now. I mean, what does it say about the whole international system that Netanyahu, who has an arrest warrant on his head from the International Criminal Court, is so certain that nothing will happen to him as he travels to the United States? I mean, doesn't this just continue to make a mockery out of the whole so-called international rule-based system and basically say that it is all null and void?
It's a broken system. It was always created as a system that was going to prop up Anglo-Zionist imperialism and protect the Russians and the Chinese. When you have a system that's undemocratic, doesn't represent the majority of the world, and it actually favors a handful of nations who have a right to veto on anything, there can be no hope for justice in those kinds of institutions, and they were never intended for that purpose. And I think the UN has shown its hypocrisy in the way that it dealt with Russia when it invaded the Ukraine, and then when Israel invades Israel, you do not get the same balanced, if you like, approach. You don't get the sanctions, you don't get the kind of the injunctions, you don't get the censorship of Israel, you don't get the control or the threats to them, even economically, diplomatically, or any level. Nothing was done to Israel to deter it. Nothing. Not the human rights organizations. There was no trade embargoes. There was no media, attack on them. They were totally supported by the Anglo-Zionist majority media, and there were certainly no trade and military embargoes. Nothing changed. So clearly, something is very, very wrong with these corrupt institutions on an international level. So you cannot expect anything. And of course, going to America for Benjamin Netanyahu is like going back home. It's like second home, maybe first home, as far as I can see. There would be no deterrent for him to go there, because there's no intention of America to abide by international law. It does not even want to accept the Geneva Convention anymore. There are no rules anymore. Israel has basically destroyed all international rule books by what it's done in Gaza, and that's a precedent that they're setting, which they want to carry out in the future elsewhere. Now, the reality is that Netanyahu has achieved what the international institutions and these corrupt Anglo-Zionist imperialist governments may well be supporting and covering Benjamin Netanyahu's genocidal behavior. But what has he achieved? He's destroyed Gaza buildings, but Israel, he's destroyed Israel too in many ways, if not irrevocably. There are many other instances I could show you where, you know, Israel's more hated. It's got the corruption of the politicians internationally has been exposed. All of these institutions, as you mentioned, have been exposed. Normalization still isn't possible with the Abraham Accords that Trump, I think, wants to still push, because he wants to keep the Arabs on board. He wants them to finance whatever new Greater Israel they want to establish. So there's a little lull, but I don't think it'll last long. And I agree with my colleague. They have no intention of fulfilling the second phase of this ceasefire.
All right. Well, Saad, based on who the Zionists are, I mean, isn't it even more remarkable that the Palestinian resistance has made the Israeli regime release Palestinians as part of the agreement? And doesn't it prove once again that not only the power of the resistance, but really that resistance is the only way to deal with this regime and the only way to victory? I mean, your thoughts.
Yeah, I believe that the Palestinians now have reached a level to understand quite well and to support that the armed struggle is the most important element in, stopping Israel of doing anything else. After the 7th of October 2023, it became now obvious, and the support to the resistance, not only in Gaza, but even in the West Bank, is growing rapidly in a very huge way. We can see that in Gaza. Their homes were destroyed, how many murders there were. And in spite of that, they were saying thank you to the resistance, and they were cheering for the resistance. And it means that in spite of all these atrocities by the Israelis, especially in Gaza, to separate the people from the resistance, thinking that if they have been harmed too much, then they will say the resistance gave us all these kind of problems. Now it's totally the opposite, and the people are around the resistance, and this is the only way for us to do it.
And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me here on the Spotlight. Saad Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator out of London, Saad Namr, professor of political science, Beresat University out of Ramallah. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on a Spotlight. Goodbye.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world on The Lantern.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear brother and sister, dear listener of IRIB English Radio, especially this program Lantern, so welcome to this episode. In this episode, we're going to speak about Sayyida Fatima, Lady Fatima to Zahra, peace be upon her, the generous lady, so be with us. Sayyida Fatima was always generous. No one turned away empty-handed from her door. Even the day of her wedding, she gave away her new dress to a beggar at her door and kept the old one for herself. She gave to others even when she needed it herself. Once when Imam Hassan, peace be upon him, and Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, were taken ill, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny advised her to make a vow to fast 3 days. When they were better, all the family fasted. Just after sunset, when it was time to break the fast and eat, there was someone at the door. "I'm needy, O family of Muhammad, help me." Ali, Fatima, Hassan, and Hussein, peace be upon them, all gave up their food to the needy man and had nothing but water that night. The next day, they spent the day fasting, and as they were ready to break their fast, there was a voice at the door. "Help me, I am an orphan and need food." Again, all of them gave their food to the orphan, staying hungry for the second night. On the third day of the fast, as they were ready to eat, a captive called out, "Help, I'm hungry." For the third time, the family of Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his pure progeny, gave away all they had. The angel Gabriel came to the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam, with the verses of the Surah Al-Insan. The Almighty Allah said, "And they feed for the love of Allah the needy, the orphan, and the captive." Holy Quran, chapter 76, verse 8. Allah praised their actions and promised them reward in the highest heaven. Sayyida Fatima has shown us that she was ready to give whatever she had to help others. She was so kind that always prayed for the people before herself and her family. Imam Hassan narrates, "I saw my mother in the prayer site, mihrab, on the Friday night when she continuously performed genuflection and prostration until the sun rose. I heard her praying for the believing men and women. She would mention their names and sincerely prayed for them, but asked nothing for herself. I said to her, 'My dear mother, why don't you pray for ourselves as you pray for others?' She replied, 'My son, we must first pray for others and then for ourselves.'" Now, in the continuation of this program, Lantern, we listen to the important point of this interesting story.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Ali, your host. Today, in this very show, we shall be talking about the best role model for a Muslim woman, who is undoubtedly Lady Fatima salamullah alayha, can be the best role model for a Muslim woman. Human nature has always maintained fixed moral principles throughout history, embedding acceptance within humanity. Modeling oneself after Fatima salamullah alayha can occur for today's woman in both direct and indirect ways. Direct modeling involves adopting her words and actions exactly as guidelines for one's own life. In certain cases, such a worship and supplication, one can emulate her behavior directly. For instance, it has been narrated that after each obligatory prayer, Fatima salamullah alayha had specific remembrances that we also follow by reciting them after our obligatory prayers. Indirect modeling involves understanding the spirit and sense behind her words or actions through analysis and inferences from her scientific and practical conduct. One can discern her responsibilities across all aspects of life. Many forms and behavioral patterns exhibited by role models were specific to particular circumstances. Thus, when referring to such behaviors for emulation, it does not mean copying their exact forms, but rather grasping their spirit and content while adapting them into new forms suited to contemporary conditions. The philosophy behind women's presence in society reflects both their social identity and their commitment to honoring Islamic social interests through sacrifice. True believers are those who believe in Allah and His Messenger while possessing a deep understanding of social issues. They actively participate in various arenas such as Friday prayers, demonstrations, elections, enjoining good and forbidding wrong, amrun bil ma'ruf wa nahyun 'anil munkar, among many other activities. One important social duty is establishing justice. This requires not only men's efforts but also women's capabilities. The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Examining Fatima's behavioral model demonstrates her steadfastness against oppression during post-prophetic times, while adhering strictly to religious norms specific to women. She courageously engaged publicly while displaying sensitivity towards surrounding issues rooted in women's human rights. Moreover, recognizing women's political participation alongside men is essential for preserving the authenticity of prophetic teachings throughout history. Islam never belittles women's roles in social life, but has established guidelines regarding how women should participate in social matters. A woman nurtured under this human model, like Fatima salamu alayha alayha, will possess constructive societal presence along with effective social management. Such presence will not only be serious, but also relevant rather than passive or indifferent. It should be noted that reason, effort, and faith are equally present in both men and women. Hence, one cannot dismiss women's social or political participation under pretext concerning public morality, because these inherent instincts are shared between genders. If deviated from their proper course, both will face danger. Women can actively participate in social roles while adhering to guidelines. Whenever the Quran speaks about lofty human qualities and values, it mentions women alongside men equally. Today, Fatima, salamu alayha, can shape Muslim women. As a mother nurturing daughters like Zainab or sons like Hassan and Hussein, peace be upon them all, she embodies another dimension. She stands by Ali alayhi salam through solitude, hardship, while also serving as a responsible social figure who remained unyielding from birth until she laid down her father's body alone on earth, buried him in solitude without ever ceasing her struggle externally against disbelief until migration, internally against deviation until death. Thank you very much, dear brothers and sisters, for staying tuned and listening to Lantern from IRB English Radio. Till our next show, I'll leave in Allah's protection. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Dear brother and sister, thank you very much for your company. This is the end of this episode of Lantern. Until a new story, fi aman Allah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
US President Donald Trump has slapped steep new tariffs on Canada, Mexico, and China. China says it will challenge the tariffs through the World Trade Organization, WTO. And Canada and Mexico have promised retaliatory action of their own. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. President Donald Trump on Saturday, 1st of February, signed an executive order that imposes 25% tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico, while adding an additional 10% levy on goods from China. Canada responded just hours later with retaliatory tariffs of its own, while Mexico said it was also planning to issue tariffs on the United States as well. China's Commerce Secretary said China would challenge the tariffs through the World Trade Organization, WTO. According to a Reuters news agency report claiming that the move seriously violates World Trade Organization rules. The salvo, which President Donald Trump had threatened even before returning to power on 20th of January, underlines his willingness to use trade policy even against some of America's largest economic allies. The tariffs take effect at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday, 4th of February. While the order imposes 25% tariffs on goods from Canada, energy resources such as oil and gas will only be hit with a 10% tariff. The order notes that should any of the three nations retaliate against the United States with import duties or similar measures, President Trump may increase or expand in scope the duties imposed under his order to ensure the efficacy of this action. According to the White House, the salvo is aimed at curbing the flow of undocumented immigrants and illicit drugs into the United States, spurring a resurgence in domestic manufacturing and raising federal revenue. In a statement posted to social media after the announcement, Donald Trump said the order was issued through the International Emergency Economic Powers Act because of the major threat of illegal aliens and deadly drugs such as fentanyl killing our citizens. Justin Trudeau announced in a news conference on Saturday night that Canada would retaliate by placing 25% tariffs against $155 billion worth of American goods, with the first set of tariffs taking effect on Tuesday, 4th of February. This will include immediate tariffs on $30 billion worth of goods as of Tuesday, 4th of February, followed by further tariffs on $125 billion worth of American products in 21 days' time, to allow Canadian companies and supply chains to seek and find alternatives. In a statement posted to social media, Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said she instructed her economic secretary to put together a response that included both retaliatory tariffs and other punitive measures in defense of Mexico's interests. The Mexican president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said, "We categorically reject the defamatory claims made by the White House accusing the government of Mexico of having alliances with criminal organizations, as well as any attempts to interfere in our territory. John Murphy, senior vice president for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which bills itself as the world's largest business organization, slammed Donald Trump's decision, writing in a statement that the imposition of tariffs under IEEPA is unprecedented, won't solve these problems, and would only raise prices for American families and upend supply chains. John Murphy, senior vice president for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, added that the chamber will consult with our members, including Main Street businesses across the country impacted by this move, to determine next step to prevent economic harm to Americans. Meanwhile, Bob Hemesath, an Iowa farmer and board chairman of Farmers for Free Trade, an agricultural group which advocates for more open trade, said in a statement that Canada, Mexico and China are indispensable markets for the livelihood of the American agricultural economy. And placing tariffs on the three largest export markets for American farmers and ranchers, particularly for an extended period of time, would have severe consequences for the American agricultural industry. House Speaker Mike Johnson praised the order, writing on social media that Mr. Trump is holding Mexico, Canada and China accountable for their role in the flow of illegal aliens and illicit drugs across our borders. These countries are now on notice to work quickly to stop the madness. This is long overdue. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer criticized the move in a series of social media posts. In one of his posts, Chuck Schumer said, "You're worried about grocery prices, but Trump is raising prices with his tariffs." Experts warned that the impact of the tariffs could affect the economies of Canada, Mexico, and China, the nation's three biggest trading partners, as well as the United States itself. Canada's economy could shrink by 3.6%, while Mexico's economy could take a 2% hit, according to Cornell University's economics professor, Wendong Zhang. At the same time, inflation in the United States could rise by as much as 1 percentage point, pushing it as high as 4% on the annual basis, or double the U.S. Federal Reserve's goal of a 2% annual rate, according to Capital Economics, in its report, which came out on 28th of January. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story and tells us more. President Donald Trump announced extraordinary new tariffs on Mexico, Canada and China, signing the long-promised economic policy at his Mar-a-Lago club on Saturday, 1st of February. The Trump administration said tariffs are aimed at curbing the flow of drugs and undocumented immigrants into the United States, but they potentially risk substantial price increases for American consumers across an array of common goods, from avocados to sneakers to cars. Just hours later, Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, said her country will impose retaliatory tariffs. And Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, announced far-reaching retaliatory levies. China's Commerce Secretary said China will file a complaint with the World Trade Organization, WTO, and take corresponding countermeasures without elaborating further. The tariffs and subsequent retaliation risk igniting a trade war that could significantly damage the economies of the targeted countries as well as the United States itself. In anticipation, Trump's executive action includes a clause that allows the president to expand the tariffs if a country imposes new tariffs on the United States. The new policy represents a reversal of virtual duty-free trade among the three North American nations that's existed for several years, and an expansion of a frosty trade war between China and the United States that has escalated over the past two administrations. As Donald Trump has repeatedly promised over the past several months, the tariffs will amount to a significant 25% duty on all imports from Mexico and most goods from Canada, and a 10% tariff on Chinese goods imported into the United States. The tariffs will have no exemptions, and the executive action Trump signed on Saturday, 1st of February, will close the so-called de minimis loophole that had allowed shipments of $800 or less to come into the United States tax-free, a key provision used by many American small businesses, but also Chinese e-commerce companies such as Shein and Temu. The Trump administration officials said the loophole prevented customs officials from properly inspecting those packages. Although Trump administration officials said on Saturday that tariffs were designed to stop the flow of fentanyl and undocumented immigrants into the United States, they gave no specific benchmark for the new import taxes to be lifted, other than the cessation of the drugs and undocumented immigrants coming into the country. Notably, the tariffs included an important carve-out. The tariff on Canadian energy products will be 10%. Many Americans rely on Canadian energy products, including oil, electricity and natural gas, for fuel and home heating. The cost of those items will rise when the tariffs hit. To put the tariffs in place, Donald Trump in his executive action declared a national economic emergency, invoking the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, known as IEEPA, which authorizes a president to unilaterally manage imports during a national emergency. The tariffs are set to go into effect on Tuesday, 4th of February at 12:01 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.